Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On our program today, new vaccine recommendations from NACI, but more confusion. The National Advisory Committee on Immunization has new recommendations for Johnson & Johnson vaccine for people 30 and over. But why are they telling some people to consider waiting for other vaccines? Is confusion clouding the clarity on these life-saving vaccines? We're going to get the latest from the chair of NACI, Dr. Caroline Quash, and a prairie fire, a wicked third wave, and a shutdown of the legislature in Alberta. What's going on there?
With so much tragic loss that, frankly, could have been avoided, this premier has now run and gone into hiding. He's a coward.
Alberta opposition parties slammed Premier Jason Kenney's response to the COVID-19 crisis. The province has the highest rate of active cases per capita in this country. Is this really the time to shut down the legislature? What's happening there? We did ask Premier Jason Kenney to join us today. He was unavailable, but we will bring in opposition leader and former Premier Rachel Notley. Then, a call for Justin Trudeau to fire his chief of staff, Katie Telford.
If the Prime Minister is telling the truth and he wants Canadians to believe that he had no knowledge of an allegation of sexual misconduct brought with respect to Mr. Vance, he should fire his chief of staff.
Did the Prime Minister's chief of staff really know there was an allegation of sexual misconduct against Canada's former top soldier? Did she tell the Prime Minister? The House Defence Committee was set to debate bringing Katie Telford in for questioning today, but that meeting was abruptly cancelled. What happened? Defence MPs are here to debate what needs to happen now. Plus, a damning report on long-term care.
This was a war in our long-term care homes, and our long-term care homes were on the front line.
Okay, another horrible report on long-term care homes, specifically in Ontario. Why is the federal government waiting to unveil national standards for long-term care that they promised in the budget when provinces have clearly, well, some provinces have failed? We're going to ask the seniors, federal seniors minister, Deb Schult. We did ask the woman you just saw there, the Ontario Minister of Long-Term Care. She was not available. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. There's a safety risk. They are not the preferred vaccines. Those are just some of the phrases today from the National Advisory Committee on Immunization when they were asked about AstraZeneca and the new vaccine, Johnson & Johnson. Both are called viral vectors vaccine. They are not the mRNA vaccines like Pfizer or Moderna, which apparently NACI calls the preferred vaccines. But why was Dr. Deeks of NACI reiterating these concerns out loud? Well, today, the National Advisory Committee on Immunization unveiled their guidelines for the single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine, recommending it for Canadians age 30 and up, not for pregnant women. But the question as to when you might get a Johnson & Johnson Janssen vaccine is still very much in the air. After all, on Friday, Health Canada held back its first shipment of the 300,000 doses of that vaccine because of a quality control review. Like the AstraZeneca vaccine, the National Advisory Committee on Immunization is recommending that if Canadians could wait, and it's okay to wait for the preferred mRNA vaccine like Pfizer, Moderna, then you should, depending on your personal risk of contracting COVID-19. Is that a confusing message? What happened to the best vaccine is the first one you get in a pandemic? Let's find out. Joining me now is Dr. Caroline Quash, of course, the chair of the National Advisory Committee on Immunization. Dr. Quash, always good to have you on the program. Doc, I got to ask this question because, of course, more messaging today that a lot of folks, doctors included, said they were confusing about Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca. Can you just tell our audience why, why NACI is saying if you want to wait for an mRNA vaccine, in other words, AstraZeneca or Pfizer, yeah, you should, but there are young people in their 30s and 40s in ICUs right now, as you know, across this country. Why shouldn't NACI just say, we understand there are risks, the best vaccine is the first one to take? Why give people the option to wait when the variants are ravaging even young people?
Because it basically depends on where you are. So if you are in an area where there's no COVID, then waiting for mRNA is okay. What we're saying is really, you know, do an individual risk assessment. If you're in an area where there's tons of COVID, the transmission is high, then I absolutely agree. The first vaccine that comes is the one that you take. However, given the number of doses of mRNA vaccines that are coming within the next week or so, if, you know, you have to know that AstraZeneca and the Janssen vaccine come with risks of VIT, so of this thrombosis that might happen. And so, as I say, you know, if you don't have any risk of catching COVID, either because there's nothing around you, because you're working from home and you're not seeing anyone, are you going to take the risk of 1 in 100,000 of having a thrombosis? Or are you going to wait 2 to 3 weeks and then get the mRNA vaccine, for which there's no safety signal of that sort? So it's really this transparent message that we have tried to send to, you know, Canadians in general.
But I just wonder, because if you look, Ontario's in a lockdown, Quebec's fighting it, BC's in Alberta. Now we're seeing everyday stories of people in their 30s and 40s who are in ICUs. Doctors are completely overwhelmed, as you know. Like, why give people this kind of option? They're not epidemiologists. They're not doctors. Why not just have a consistent message that's aligned with Health Canada and said, look, you all know the risks of AstraZeneca or Johnson & Johnson, but look, AstraZeneca has been taken over 100 million times. All of the UK has taken it. There are some risks, but the risks of COVID are so overwhelming. Take it, take it, take it. If you want, you give the option. Isn't that just contributing to confusion and hesitancy?
Well, I don't think so, because, see, the problem is if you say that any vaccine is equivalent to another, which could be true in some circumstances, you also require people to be able to make that decision. And what we want is to protect people who are not able to think necessarily through the pros and cons of every vaccine. The question is really to say this needs to be an informed consent. If, for instance, my sister was to get the AstraZeneca vaccine and die of a thrombosis, when I know that it could have been prevented and that she's not in a high-risk area, I'm not sure I could live with it. So it's really true that
thinking... But that's so rare. Like, I understand that, but...
I agree with you.
It's so rare, but when you say that, you know, mm-hmm. risk is not necessarily calculated, you know, rationally. People are more scared of the vaccine, but they're going to drive in their car. There might be 20 car accidents in their city if they don't stop driving.
I agree.
So I'm just, when someone of your stature says that, gosh, what if it happened? But it's so rare. It's significantly more dangerous to get COVID.
It is when there is COVID around. And that's what we've been saying. It means, you know, you have to look at the epidemiology in your area, and that's why provinces have to look at it personally. If you're in Toronto and the incidence rate is very high, I fully agree. Your benefits outweigh risk by magnitude. But you really have to see what your risk and what's happening around you. We can't just say that for every circumstance, all the vaccines are equivalent, because there has been this safety signal with the viral vector vaccines. Honestly, I would have loved that no safety signal ever arose, but they are there, and I can't, again, push them under the carpet.
Right. I mean, I know Health Canada says they're all safe, but then NACI's got, as you say, you're talking about the risk. NACI also today recommended mRNA vaccines for pregnant women. Are a viral vectors vaccine too much of a risk? So just so people appreciate, you recommended Pfizer and Moderna, but not necessarily Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca. Can you outline that?
Correct, because we have, well, first, none of the pregnant women were not included in those clinical trials for any vaccine. However, we have now 34,000 women or so that have been vaccinated with an mRNA vaccine in the U.S. who are pregnant, and that were followed during pregnancy, in whom no adverse event occurred. So at least we have data for the mRNA vaccines in pregnant women, which we don't have for the viral vector vaccines. On the other hand, if a pregnant woman was to develop a thrombosis associated with a viral vector vaccine during pregnancy, that would be impossible to treat. And so that's why we favored the mRNA vaccines for pregnant women.
A lot of people are wondering, okay, I know a lot of provinces are saying everyone 18 and up in May. A lot of folks are saying, what about my 17-year-old, my 16-year-old, my 10-year-old? When will under 18s be safe to get vaccinated?
So that's coming. We're waiting to hear from Health Canada for their authorization for the 12 to 15-year-old. At this point in time, Pfizer is already approved for 16 and over. So in some provinces for teenagers with the medical conditions, they have been vaccinated if they're 16 and older. For the 12 to 15, you know, we expect to have vaccination programs in place during the summer, early fall. At this point in time, 6 months to 12 years of age are currently being enrolled in studies to make sure that we understand what dose to use, that they are immunogenic, safe, and efficacious. So that should come, I guess, towards the end of 2021.
You know, just finally, because of the hesitancy and all these risks, you got this New York Times article concluding that the U.S. is not even going to be able to achieve herd immunity, not only because of the spread of the variants, but also because of vaccine hesitancy. A lot of folks, by the way, aren't even taking their second shot. What does Canada need to do to achieve herd immunity?
I'm not sure. I don't think I have the magic recipe. What we're aiming for is at least 85% of vaccination coverage. But how to get there? I mean, at this point in time, we're still in the period where vaccine supply is constrained. So people who are going for vaccines are people who want to. And I think we should move through that line of people who want to be vaccinated, give that second dose as quickly as possible, and then get to people who are hesitant. But I think that, you know, talking and being transparent with the data so that hesitant people don't feel that we're trying to hide things from them is what is going to be most useful to my stand, I guess.
All right. I do have to leave it there, even though I feel like I'm now on the non-preferred vaccine list. I'm an AstraZeneca guy. But
at the same time, you're
super
protected.
Happy to be there. I'm happy. Exactly. I have no problems.
But all that's right. An individual decision, and I think it was a great decision from where you live.
I'm feeling good about it. Dr. Caroline Quash, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to pick up that later. But again, make of that what you want. There's interval issues, you know, when to take these things, which one to take. But again, the message is all these vaccines are safe, and then you calibrate that through the national the NACI recommendations there, but maybe have your own decision. So interesting stuff there from Dr. Caroline Quash. Meantime, as I was saying, the third wave is crushing places, especially Alberta. Get this. Alberta is now the worst COVID-19 hotspot, not only in the country, but in North America. The province has the highest per capita active caseload in Canada and in the United States, which is pretty remarkable. And in the midst of the crisis, I should say, Alberta Premier Jason Kenney has just suspended the spring sitting of the provincial legislature for at least 2 weeks due to the record cases, as well as fears of MLAs traveling to Edmonton, not to Hawaii, as some did earlier, leading to further spread in the response. In response, Alberta's official opposition leader, Rachel Notley, has had some choice words for the premier. Former Premier Notley called Jason Kenney a coward and accused him of running and hiding as her party was set to propose an emergency debate on the province's pandemic response. But is this really a case of the premier cutting and running, or is this suspension a signal to Albertans of how bad things have got? We're going to bring in Rachel Notley, Alberta NDP leader and the former premier. We did ask again for Jason Kenney to join us. He was unavailable. Rachel Notley, good to have you on the program. You're not mincing words here, calling Jason Kenney a coward. Is he shutting it down to shut down debate, or is it prudent when Alberta is getting crushed by the third wave? Why should MLAs be going to the legislature?
Well, I guess there's a couple of key points here. The first thing I would say is, interestingly, UCP MLAs did actually travel across Alberta in order to show up in the legislature building today. They showed up for committee meetings and other things. They just didn't show up for question period or in the legislature itself. So that puts even more questioning to the rationale that Jason Kenney provided yesterday. But more to the point, here's the thing. Under the leadership of this premier, we have servers still weaving their way around full tables of maskless people who are eating on patios. We have retail workers trying to elbow their way through crowds in malls. We have teachers going into classrooms of 49-year-olds, many of whom are not masked.
Right.
So if those folks can show up for work, then I find it very difficult to accept that suddenly Jason Kenney is at great risk. And if this is a premier who is really concerned about setting a good example for Albertans, then I would suggest he start by disciplining those multiple members of his caucus who are actively undermining the merits of the public health rules which are in place right now.
Okay, by the way, how did things get so bad there? We're hearing it's the worst per capita in not only our country, but in North America.
Yeah, no, it is true. And you know, I look at those numbers and I look at the maps that show that Alberta is the worst. And I kind of wonder, too, what's going on here? But really, you know, I think it comes down to the fact that for 13 or 14 months, this premier himself has actively undermined public health measures. He's actively undermined the rules that are in place. He's claimed that they run against our economic interests. He's claimed that they restrict freedom. He's claimed that we're only dealing with the flu. He's allowed his caucus to undermine them. He's not enforcing
but he's
the rules.
Then done,
we got 2,000 people at a rodeo.
But he's now slapped down some restrictions.
Pardon
me? Rachel Notley, he's now slapped down restrictions, and I know he's got more restrictions finally. I know his own caucus, many of them don't like them, the 17 of them that I wrote. But what else needs to happen, if you, in your view? Like, do they need a more robust restrictions?
Well, let's two things. First of all, I will say that the restrictions that he put in place, first of all, he lifted restrictions prematurely in February. That was the first thing that he did. Secondly, the restrictions he put in place 3.5 months ago or weeks ago were half measures. Thirdly, the so-called restrictions he put in place late last week are non-events. That was a performative event. If you dig into it, with the exception of the fitness studios who've been ground down by this government over the course of the last 12 months, there was nothing new in there. So he hasn't really done that. It has been performative. He also excluded the ridings of effectively of most of his MLAs from being a subject to those restrictions. So that's the first thing. But the other thing is that he says, oh, well, none of these restrictions will ever work because no one follows them. And if the concern is that no one is following them, then that's where he needs to take some responsibility. Again, because of the way in which he's been communicating to Albertans about these restrictions from day one, and then the fact that he's not enforcing where people are actively flouting them, like, as I say, for example, 2,000 people showing up at a rodeo this weekend and not a single penalty assessed to this point.
Yeah, I just, again, we all saw the footage of the anti-lockdown rodeo from this weekend in Bowden, Alberta. It caught national attention, people without masks, congregating. As you say, there was not a single penalty there. Just real quick, you were going to propose an emergency debate at the legislature if it was open. It's now closed. What would you have proposed?
Well, we would have wanted to talk about a number of things. So, for instance, today we proposed four elements to enhancing enforcement in the province in order to get the message out to folks that even though the premier's been vacillating on these health restrictions, that in fact they're real. We would have proposed bringing in a sick leave program because we know that's critical to helping folks stay out of the workplace when they are feeling ill or whether they've been exposed. So those were a couple of things, and there were a number of other issues that we would have been addressing with respect to supporting kids who've been sent home recently, as well as providing more support to our frontline healthcare workers.
Well, again, I really appreciate you joining us. Again, we did ask a representative of the Kenney government, and no one was made available, but Rachel Notley, leader of the official opposition, former premier, thank you so much. Stay safe in Alberta.
Thank you so much. You too.
All right, that is Rachel Notley there. We want to hear from you. Do you have thoughts on the program, on any of the stories we've talked about? The vaccination confusion, restrictions, lockdowns, how politicians are responding. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, email, you name it. Heck, if you have TikTok, send us a like. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up next, will the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, Katie Telford, actually get fired over the handling of the 2018 Vance allegations as the opposition wants? Who knew what when? Defense MPs are up next to debate the details of this issue. Stay with us.
So
are we to believe that Katie Telford kept the prime minister in the dark about sexual misconduct allegations while she watched him reward, praise, and even promote General Vance?
No, I did not know the nature of these specific details. I repeat that Mr. Walburn brought up concerns of misconduct involving the former chief of defense staff. He did not give me any details.
So the Conservatives are calling on the Prime Minister to fire Katie Telford as chief of staff. Why? Well, they say she deserves to get shown the door because they say she failed to tell him about the allegation of sexual misconduct levied against the former chief of the defense staff, General Jonathan Vance, when it was brought to light March 1st, 2018. General Vance has reportedly denied allegations against him, but we still don't know what exactly Katie Telford understood those allegations to be about. Did Minister Sajjan know it was an allegation about sexual misconduct? Did he convey that to Katie Telford? Other than the Prime Minister saying his team didn't know it was a, quote, Me Too complaint. Remember he said that in the House. No one in my office knew it was a Me Too complaint. Is that true? Well, today the Defense Committee was set to debate calling Katie Telford to testify. That meeting was shut down or canceled by the Liberal Chair Karen McCrimmon. But is this really going to demand the firing of the chief of staff? Who knew what when? Let's find out. MPs are here from the Defense Committee. Anita Vandenbelt is the parliamentary secretary to the defense minister. James Bazan is the conservative defense critic. And Randall Garrison is the NDP defense critic. Good to see you all. I'm just going to start with you, Ms. Vandenbelt, because I've asked you this before. You were on this program. You told me that Mr. Walburn did not say that he told Mr. Sajjan, the defense minister, that it was an allegation of sexual misconduct. He did twice say that to committee, as I told you. But I then spoke to Mr. Walburn again, just to clarify. I want to show you. This is what he alleges he said. Here's what he said.
I did tell Minister Sajjan that I had received a complaint of inappropriate sexual behavior against the chief of defense staff. Those were my exact words. That's what I testified to in front of committee, and it is what it is.
He's very clear. He told the defense minister. So either the Liberal position is he's telling a lie, or the defense minister knew. And my question is, if he knew it was an allegation of sexual misconduct, why did the prime minister say no one in his office knew, and who did he tell?
So, first of all, I stand corrected about the testimony, but what Minister Sajjan said very clearly is that he disagreed with those aspects of Mr. Walburn's testimony. And what then you get into is a he said, and I think what really matters is that regardless of the fact that they didn't know the nature or specifics of the allegations, nobody, they treated them as if they were very serious. They treated them as if it could be the worst, and they acted immediately on them. And they, in fact, used the exact same process that Mr. Novak said that the Harper Conservatives used when Mr. O'Toole brought what were actually much more specific rumors about at least two, maybe three specific cases. And in fact, what we found out this week, which is very troubling, is that they appointed General Vance as chief of defense staff while that military police investigation was still ongoing.
Okay. Before we shift the blame to the end, I think there's accountability. There's accountability on all sides, but I just want to press this. You're saying that this is a he said. So that means you're saying, in just plain language, that Gary Walburn came to committee and lied twice in his testimony, lied to a parliamentary committee about telling the defense minister that it was an allegation of inappropriate sexual misconduct, then came on CTV question period when I asked him again to reiterate it and lied again. So you're saying he didn't tell the Liberal defense is that Gary Walburn is a liar. Is that the defense?
What our defense is that every single witness, whether it's Mr. Wernick, Ms. Sherman, Mr. Elder, the minister several times, every single witness has said the specifics and nature of the allegation were not known. In fact, Ms. Sherman asked Mr. Walburn for the nature of the allegation, not the name, and he would not provide it. And so what I am saying is that
Minister Sajjan was clear that he disagrees with the testimony. Remember, these are conversations that happened 3-4 years ago, but Minister Sajjan disagrees. And nonetheless, they acted as if they were. They acted as if it was very serious, and they made sure that they tried to be able to follow up on that, but Mr. Walburn would not provide the what it was. They didn't. It was, now we know, an email, a sexually suggestive email. We didn't know who got the email, didn't know what the email was about, didn't even know that it was an email. There was nothing known at that time. And so at this point,
well, that's not what,
all the other testimony.
Okay, but let me bring in James Buzan. So the Liberals are saying that no one knew, and that Mr. Walborn, by the way, it was only 3 years ago, it was March 1st, 2018, so just to get, it wasn't that far long ago. Mr. Buzan, what do you make of that, and does that help explain why maybe Katie Telford didn't tell the Prime Minister?
I think that Minister Sajjan and the Liberals are being disingenuous here. I believe what we heard at committee and also in multiple interviews by Gary Walborn, that he told the minister it was about sexual misconduct. We know that all of the briefing documents and memos that were going back and forth between PMO and the Privy Council Office, between the clerk of the Privy Council Office and the chief of staff to the Prime Minister, Katie Telford, all talked about sexual harassment in those emails and briefing notes. So I just don't think Canadians can believe what the Liberals are trying to sell here. And that's why we brought forward the Opposition Day motion for tomorrow, is that if Katie Telford knew about this, and the Prime Minister is being honest here, if he is being honest, and didn't know that this was about sexual misconduct, then Katie Telford failed to do her duties as chief of staff, and she should be fired. However,
but how do you know what she knew?
Trudeau's bluff
like,
here.
I'm just trying
we're
to figure out
how Prime Minister Trudeau's bluff here, in that if he says, no, she did nothing wrong, then that means that she did inform the Prime Minister about the sexual misbehavior of these allegations against General Vance. And then the Prime Minister needs to apologize to Canadians for misleading us and misleading the House and misleading veterans and those that are currently serving who are the victims of sexual misconduct in the Canadian Armed Forces.
Well, I just want to follow, and I'll bring in Mr. Garrison. I'm not sure the logic here. What if Katie Telford was not, I mean, I guess it's possible, she was not informed of the nature of the allegation? That's the Liberals' defense. How would the opposition know if she was?
Well, we would love to have her up here at Defense Committee, but the Liberals, of course, filibustered Defense Committee on Friday to ensure that we couldn't vote on the motion to invite her to come to committee. And then today canceled our Defense Committee completely. So they're trying to run and hide rather than allow us to talk to Katie Telford directly as committee members to find out what she does know. But we do know that when Elder Marquez was at committee a week and a half ago, he did talk that it was Katie Telford who told him to look into allegations against General Vance, and that he knew that they were of a sexual nature.
Let me bring in Mr. Garrison. What's the NDP's view on all this?
Well, the Liberals have several times tried to suggest it's anybody but the Minister of Defense and the Prime Minister who's responsible for this. So first they blame the Ombudsman, then they tried to blame people in the Privy Council Office, and the Prime Minister himself suggested in his press conference that it's perhaps Katie Telford. So that's the reason committee members from the opposition want to hear from her. She's the only one who can tell us if the Minister of Defense is telling the truth, because the Minister of Defense knew that this was sexual misconduct. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And he says he told the Prime Minister's office. If that's true, then the Prime Minister's office is the one who's responsible, and therefore the Prime Minister, for the fact that there was no investigation and the Chief of Defence Staff was left in office for 3 more years in charge of the program to root out sexual misconduct when he himself was accused of sexual misconduct. This is about women
just Mr. Garrison,
and they have to have trust that people at the top will actually take effective action.
So I just want your view. So when I know this has been bounced around for a long time. So when the Liberals say, well, we could not do much more with this because the complainant did not want to come forward, so we gave it to the PCO, we didn't want to politically interfere. What is your view on that defense of this?
Well, let's look at the outcome. There was no investigation. So you can go down the procedural rabbit hole about who within the Liberal government told who, what, when. But the fact is there was no investigation. And the fact is the defense minister even admitted that he didn't look at the evidence that was offered to him of sexual misconduct. So no action, no responsibility, and then no trust in Canadian forces that things will be taken seriously enough to actually be investigated if you comply.
Yeah, Anita Vandermeulen, just before I let you go, I mean, people are trying to having trouble taking the government seriously on this. This is a government, a defense minister who over 5 years did very little to implement the 2015 Deschamps report. We just had allegations of over 580 sexual assaults in the last 5 years under the Liberals' watch, under the defense minister watch. Another top-ranking member, the commander of the Canadian Special Operations Forces Command, Major General Peter Daw, placed on leave indefinitely, writing a letter supporting a member found guilty of sexual assault. Now this allegation that when a complaint came forward, now the military ombudsman is a liar. Why does given the track record, not implementing the report, so much sexual assault, why would anyone believe that the actions of this government are serious on this issue?
Well, first of all, I think that when you look at the Deschamps report, what perhaps was done wrong is that we left it to the military and the department to interpret and implement. This time we have Madame Arbour, and even Madame Deschamps has said that her mandate is much broader and she welcomes it, who will actually be looking at the how. And this is the first time, this is significant. You have all of the top military leadership and the department who are saying they will accept having external oversight, external reporting mechanisms. And
remember, Deschamps, to be fair, that was proposed 6 years ago when you didn't do it. External oversight was part of the Deschamps report. Just get it done. I don't get that.
And let's look at what we put. We created a whole new institution, the SMRC, the Sexual Misconduct Response Centers. It was taken, the interpretation of independent was outside of CAF, but under the department. Now what we're realizing is we need to make sure that it's completely outside the department. And this is the mandate of the how. Madame Deschamps did a wonderful job of outlining the problem and recommending having our body. But had what we're creating now, had this been in place in 2015, in 2018, then we would have had the ability where people could come forward safely and securely. We are putting that in place now, and we are doing so after having done an entire piece of legislation, Bill C-77, created a whole new institution, done a review of all of the unfounded cases. There have been many steps taken. The thing is, this is the first time. The military is accepting it's going to be outside of the military.
The sad story here is that the victims of sexual misconduct in the Canadian Armed Forces want results. They don't want another report. They don't want another study.
Starting within weeks.
All right, unfortunately, I've got it.
So now it's
time to stop the cover. We're going to continue this debate. Ms. Van Belt and Mr. Bazin and Mr. Garrison. Gosh, we need a lot more time on this, and I'm sure at committee you wanted more time on this as well. I should remind our viewers that these are lots of allegations against General Vance. They are unproven, of course, at this moment. He's denied them, not to CTV, but to another media source. Coming up, a devastation in Ontario's long-term care homes from the pandemic. Is the provincial government to blame? We'll get reaction to the latest report by Ontario's long-term care COVID commission from the federal seniors minister, Deb Schultz. When are those long-term care standards coming from the federal government? We'll find out next. Welcome back to the program. Ontario's long-term care sector, wholly ill-prepared for the pandemic, chronic underfunding, staffing shortages, poor oversight, bad data, all contribute to the devastation at these homes over the past year. These are just some of the key takeaways from a damning report by Ontario's Long-Term Care COVID-19 Commission released on Friday. Remember, 80% of all deaths in the first wave were in nursing homes, long-term care facilities. The report says sweeping reforms are needed. But again, that's not even the first report. Inquiry or review into the sector. The military had one. The Auditor General of Ontario had one. What will it take finally for the federal government to say, you know what, enough's enough. I know it's provincial jurisdiction. We are going to finally set some national standards on long-term care that they promised in their recent budget. Let's find out. Joining me now is the federal seniors minister, Deb Schultz. Minister, always a pleasure to have you on the program. I want to begin with the Ontario Long-Term Care Commission's final report released late Friday. To call it damning is probably an understatement. The key takeaway is that the province was entirely unprepared for the pandemic, had no plans in place to protect long-term care homes, and the people inside had no data. The results were devastating. Critical decisions came too late. Staff and residents suffered and died. As a federal minister of this, what does that tell you, and does that urge the federal government to get on with the notion of federal national standards?
Well, what it does tell us, Evan, is that there's a lot of work to be done, and all levels of government need to work together to improve the outcomes for seniors. That we know that the tragedy as a result of the pandemic, first wave and second wave, was something that we just cannot have happen again. So that's why the federal level of government, even though it is provincial jurisdiction, stepped up in the early days to give advice, infection and prevention advice to the homes to help protect those in living in long-term care. We obviously was very engaged in getting PPE because we could see the challenges there around the world, getting your hands on PPE. You know, billions of dollars was brought forward for that. Stepping up in terms of wage support for the provinces and territories to help those working in essential working, just like those in long-term care. They needed more support, so we stepped up to do that with $3 billion. And in the fall economic statement, we put additional $1 billion to help with infection prevention and control. That's on top of the $740 million that we provided. So we've been providing a lot of money, a lot of support. You saw where the military had to come in and help with, we supported Red Cross to help step in and help. So we've been there. It is the jurisdiction of the provinces and territories, right, but we have been there to support them all along.
And I know that. And I know, as you said in the budget, $3 billion set aside for long-term care and seniors. That's going to flow 2023. But let me just go back to the question of national standards for long-term care. Promised in the budget. I understand it's provincial jurisdiction, but look, we had the military report both in Quebec and Ontario that was damning. We've had an Auditor General's report on this in Ontario, damning. We've had this long-term care report late Friday, damning. At what point do you say, we've given you billions of dollars, you failed, the federal government is going to have long-term enforceable standards that are tied to this money? Why not do that? Why give money to places that are not proving that they can get the job done and keep people safe and alive?
Well, first off, our work to this point has been to support the provinces and territories because it's really important to make sure we recognize where the challenges have been in personnel, in facilities, in infection prevention control, access to PPE. So it's important to step up right away to improve the outcomes for seniors that live in those facilities. And we are starting to see the outcome of, you know, vaccination, focusing on the most senior and in congregate living. So, you know, there have been strategies that have been working. There's a lot of work to do. It's certainly revealed where those shortcomings are. But the federal government needed to be stepping up right away to be there with the resources, right, with the money, and help the provinces to get through. Not all provinces were facing the same challenges.
I get it. I'll ask you one last time, though. When will the government come through with the promise of national standards on long-term care? It's in the budget. When will we see it?
Right. So those discussions are already underway with the provinces and territories. I'm having them with my counterparts, as is Minister Haidu. You know that the Health Standards Organization and the Canadian Standards Association have already started to work on laying out national standards, and they'll be developing those in conjunction with the provinces and territories, stakeholders and Canadians, and that work is underway. And in the meantime, we're making sure that we are there with the provinces and territories. We put $1 billion into the fall economic statement that is now rolling out with bilateral agreements to help infection prevention control in the facilities today. So we are doing work today while that work to look at standards is underway.
Just last question. The Ontario Minister of Long-Term Care, Minister Marilee Fullerton, faced reporters today, eventually walked out, but mostly blamed previous governments and community spread for the damage. She was asked if she would apologize. She refused to apologize. I know that the Finance Minister and Deputy Prime Minister, Chrystia Freeland, actually did apologize when she delivered the budget. Should ministers like the minister in Ontario be apologizing to seniors and people in long-term care homes and their families for the tragedy that unfolded?
I think we all at different levels of government need to recognize what happened in the pandemic to those living in long-term care, and we need to step up and make sure that we don't ever have that happen again. And that's the focus that I've been. Let's do what we need to do today to make them safer and work at making sure that we never see this again and these tragedies are averted and that our seniors can have a safe place to live no matter where they choose to live, long-term care or being at home.
Especially after this crisis is finally over. Let's hope that the spotlight doesn't leave that situation. And Minister, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Coming up next, Alberta setting records, but not the ones they can be proud of. COVID-19 cases out of control. What will it take to put a cap on it? The Press Gallery weighs in next on that and lots more. Stay right here with Power Play. Look, these were really startling images out of Bowden, Alberta over the weekend. And no more lockdowns rodeo drew thousands of people together in the rural community. It was held despite the province setting records for COVID-19 infections, not only in Canada, but in the United States as well. Alberta leads the way nationally and compared to the United States per capita. No one, by the way, was ticketed or fined in that rodeo. So something's got to give. What's going on there? Talk about that and the confusing message about what vaccine should people take. The Press Gallery is going to weigh in. Todd McCharles, senior reporter with the Toronto Star. Ian Bailey, reporter with the Globe and Mail. And our special guest is infectious disease physician, Dr. Lorna Saxinger. Great to have you, Doc. I want to start with you and good to have everyone here. Can you give us a sense of how there are restrictions in place in Alberta? Why are things on fire there so badly? What happened?
Well, I think it's probably a combination of several things. One is we now have the B.1.1.7 dominant in our population. It took a while to become completely dominant, but now it really is. We've had, some elements of restriction fatigue are at play, even for people who've been doing all the right things for a really long time, and people are potentially less engaged. We also have this almost parallel reality where there is a subset of people that seems to be fairly substantial that really doesn't share the same appreciation for the seriousness of COVID as everyone else does. And that's leading to some behaviors like we saw with the large gatherings that we've been seeing. And that can be a really important factor as well. And there's just simply too many people contacting too many people with a highly, highly transmissible variant strain of COVID.
Right, but Ian Bailey, I mean, I know B.1.1.7's taken over there, but it's also been in British Columbia, just hasn't had nearly the same impact. What do you think the difference is in terms of why things are just so brutal in Alberta?
Well, here in BC, we're canceling our venerable rodeos, Cloverdale, North Thompson, Fall Fair. People aren't going to rodeos, and I think that people clearly are taking it more seriously here, and maybe there's been a more consistent approach by the province. 740 cases in BC on Friday compared to more than 2,400 in Alberta on Saturday. So, you just look at this, what's going on in Alberta, it's very sad, it's very concerning, and it's hard to figure out where they've gone wrong. But clearly BC is on a better track for a whole number of reasons.
Yeah, Tonda, by the way, they've canceled the spring legislature there, which is odd since people are still, there's all sorts of other activities they're doing. What do you make of that? And does this reflect on the political leadership of Jason Kenney at this moment?
Well, of course it does. And I think that Jason has struggled with trying to juggle that balance, the very strong desire for freedoms and a relaxing of restrictions with the public health imperative. And the doctor outlined it perfectly. But look, it's interesting that nobody's really, this is not anybody's first rodeo, is it? We saw what happened in Newfoundland when they went from zero to 400, 500 cases in a week. Now Nova Scotia and Manitoba also grappling rising cases. Ontario is finally managing to start bringing its daily case count down, but we're still seeing this tremendous impact on the hospital system. So I think that there's no mystery around what it takes to contain these viruses and the variants. We know that the public health measures, in the absence of a ramped up vaccine supply, which is coming, they work. So I think that, you know, it takes a bit of political courage. And so far, Jason Kenney hasn't displayed that.
Dr. Sachinger, what did you make of the National Council of Immunization today saying essentially, look, there's two preferred vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, the mRNAs, and if you're in a certain category, you might want to wait for those, as opposed to that clear, concise message of the best vaccine is the first one you can get. Is that contributing to a critical vaccine hesitancy when people really just should get any vaccine they want in the view of many doctors?
I do think that that messaging, I mean, it, at the end of the day, it is actually a risk-benefit decision for people. But I think that the messaging kind of neglects the setting. And the setting right now in Alberta is of just, you know, astronomically high case rates and a lot of transmission. And so, you know, for most people in Alberta, we should have no vaccine on the shelves. It should all be in the arms. And yet we have open vaccine appointments, you know, all over the place right now. And so I think that is a really big concern. The risk benefit really actually has to balance, like, look at what your real risk is right now. And for most people, all of the vaccines that are licensed are good. They all are very effective at preventing hospitalization and death. And the risk benefit has been worked out. So I do think that the messaging does kind of make it more difficult, I think, to communicate that to people who are in a place with very high rate of transmission.
Yeah, Tondi, want to weigh in on that? I thought it was confusing today.
Yeah, no, it is confusing. And there's no question that, you know, maybe NACI has a role in advising provincial health authorities on, you know, priority access. But honestly, as a public health message, it's terrible. It's confusing. It's contradictory. Many people don't know what to make of it. And I think that between NACI and Health Canada and the Public Health Agency, they all three have to get their acts together and come out with a consistent message so that provinces and territories and individuals can make risk assessments based on a coherent line of thought and communication.
Just last word, a couple seconds for you, Ian, if you want to weigh in on that.
Yeah, it does work against the sort of the push that we've seen. It doesn't really make a lot of sense, and given the urge for people to take whatever vaccine is available. Going back to Alberta very quickly, closing the legislature doesn't exactly bring a sense of calm, especially when legislatures across the country, including Parliament, have managed to do their business during these challenging times.
I got to leave it there. Dr. Sachinger, Ian Bailey, and Tawny McCharles, great to have the three of you on the program. You know, I don't know what the doctors are saying, but I'd take any vaccine I can get. That's Power Play. Thanks for watching. We'll be back here in 23 short hours. Take care.